session number 10599, reel 10.
Major English, reel 10. Would you go on, Major, with the story of the battle?
After lying there for a bit of time, the thing quietened a little bit, and I ran across back to company headquarters. Very soon after I got there, the dismal cry of stretcher bearers went up, and Sergeant Appleby, it turned out, had been badly wounded very soon after I left his lit trench by this German shelling. We waited for the New Zealanders to come and relieve us, and again the night was cold, and we interminable wait, shivering and all this business. And they were late, and we thought, well, why on earth are they late? But of course that wasn't very fair. They no doubt had great problems getting up and getting to us, and they arrived about 1 a.m. and I took the New Zealand company commander round our positions and apologised to him that we only had slit trenches for about 50 to 60 men. And he said, oh, he said, that's all right. He said, I've only got 56, and I haven't had more than 75 in the company for the last 4 months. And the New Zealanders had tremendous problem with reinforcements always. Anyway, we marched out and down Boomerang Track again. And after about 3 miles, we were met by the RQMS, Battalion RQMS Lightfoot, with battalion transport. So we all scrambled aboard and got back to our old area. That is, the one we were in just immediately before the attack. And apart from a minimum of sentries, everyone just lay down, collapsed to sleep, the sleep of the just, I think. The next day, that was the 4th of November, the brigadier came round and congratulated everybody on the action, and we also discussed some of the lessons that had become apparent and we ought to learn. The first was necessity of keeping near the barrage. We reported that the smoke was a nuisance, and how valuable the red tracer from the Beauforts was in keeping direction. We discussed the tremendous difficulty there seemed to be in getting supporting arms up, not only because of German opposition, but also organization of the tracks and the movement of MT and getting them up where they should be, and in many cases left the infantry out supporting arms. I myself, and I think the others, agreed the necessity of in an attack, a night attack of that sort, of essential to keep the company together and keep everyone from going in the right direction. So really, that sort of battle is very much a company commander's battle. Street fighting, I think, is probably a section commander's battle, and a daylight attack, probably the platoon commander is the most important. But in that sort of attack that we had just done behind the barrage at night, the company commander isn't so much a commander, really, as a leader of 100 or so chaps who had to keep them, essential to keep them together. So that was really our part in the Battle of El Alamein, which, although we didn't know it then, is now known as the turning point of the war.
Can I just ask one or two questions? When you got back, when you were completely cleared and so on, is fatigue the first thing that hits you?
I think so. That and learning of people you knew well who'd been killed that you didn't know till after the battle. But I think it's fatigue and being able to sleep without worrying about having to wake up for some alarm.
Were any of the men suffering, or did you see any of the men suffering from shell shock, the heavy bombardments that they themselves had to go under?
Well, there may have been. I don't remember seeing any. In other battles at Merath, for instance, one day I did see that in one or two cases, but in this instance I didn't. And but I'm not saying it didn't happen. One or two perhaps were evacuated that I didn't know anything about who were shocked, too shocked perhaps to continue.
Have you any recollections of your own officers in your own company who did particularly well there?
No, they did a good job. They did the job that they were there to do, and they did well. I did not recommend any of the officers of the company for a decoration, but I did recommend the company sergeant major Ransom, who had been particularly good in dealing with parties of enemy that had been perhaps left behind or had not been covered, and he was as steady as a rock and he did very well. He was recommended for an M.
Were any of the men the company awarded medals as a result of this particular action?
Yes. Well, Ransom was, as I say, and I was awarded a military cross. And the rest of the battalion, a sergeant in A company, and two private soldiers, one in platoon, one in B company, and the CO got a DSO.
And your losses were quite heavy at the end.
Yes, probably 35-40% initially anyway. We got a few back fairly soon. But
so what happened next then, Major?
Well, we then we had 2 days really sorting ourselves out and reorganizing and resting, and during this time we got seven other rank reinforcements. Now these were all sent to my company. A and B companies were amalgamated, and these chaps arrived in C company. Well, they were Welsh Regiment and Royal Welsh Fusiliers, and they didn't really want to be in the Durham Light Infantry at all, and I don't blame them. Some of them could talk Welsh easier than they could talk English, and they took quite a bit of absorbing. But it was amazing, really. We got on. And by the time the next battle came, there was as much Durham infantry as anybody else. But it was quite an interesting situation. And then on the 5th of November, we came under the 9th Australian Division. and we set off marching from Tel Elisa. Apparently the orders had been wrong. We should have got into transport, and I think the corps commander was far from pleased to see these chaps marching. Anyway, we eventually got into Australian transport and drove westwards towards Old Darba. And the whole world seemed to be advancing westward. Tremendous columns of the British Army and the RAF, everything type of vehicle you'd think of, all driving forward, some on the road, some on the desert parallel to it, and then coming towards us with thousands of prisoners, Italians by the hundreds and Germans by the score, I suppose. And something which I hadn't seen before, Germans marching really unescorted. And I think they had really been pretty shattered. The majority of prisoners over the whole battle, of course, were Italians, because they were left on the ground without their transport. And so were sitting ducks, really, in thousands. Anyway, we got to a defensive position west of El Darba, we were still, I suppose, in the forward area, and people started digging slit trenches and this sort of thing. And then we noticed that we were being approached by about 500 enemy, and everyone stood to and got behind weapons and that sort of thing. And then it soon transpired that they were Italians surrendering. And then on the 8th, we had another change of command. We were put under 51st Division. But we were also told that because of the supply situation, we were not to be part of the pursuit. And in fact, we moved then to a place further east called Bir el Mullah, which was on the Alexandra Matru Railway. And it was that night that there was a most torrential rain, which had some effect anyway, if not a dominant effect, on the conduct of the pursuit, the 8th Army pursuit of the Italians. And it can be argued that if that hadn't come, we might have been able to stop the retreat further west.
Were you sleeping in tents?
We had mainly bivouacs then. I think there were a few tents being issued, but as far as the company was concerned, they were mainly in bivouacs and got fairly wet. So then, from then on, we reverted to a out-of-operations existence. And we had generally cleaning and smartening up, sorting things out. And a few people were given leave into Alexandria, and a man called Harry Glassburn, anti-tank platoon commander, he and I were fortunate enough to be lucky in the draw, and we had 3 days in Alexandria.
How did you find the back areas of Alexandria? Were there as crowded with non-combatant troops as appears to have been?
Yes, I think so. We saw them, obviously, although we didn't get to know them or go looking for them. We went for the, I suppose, what might be termed, in inverted commas, the flesh pots. But there were quite a number. And of course, there had been a very tricky situation in the base areas. Place was running with spies, and there was developing quite a pro-German feeling amongst the Egyptians. But that, of course, had changed now, and the British were everything that was wonderful. But of course, a lot from then on, a lot of the base people began to move up into the desert, which suited some and not others, I think.
Did you lose your brigadier about this time?
Yes, we did. He, whether it was the result of the mess up of the initial pursuit, I don't know. That was one story that was about. But Brigadier Percy was replaced. He was then given the job of commanding the Middle East Octu. And he was replaced by Brigadier Beek, who was a war VC and who had been in Malta. In fact, at that stage, Malta had two V's. General Gort was the commanding troops in Malta. Anyway, General Brigadier Beek arrived. And although initially we didn't see a great deal of him, but he was a fiery little man.
Was Percy missed when he left the brigade?
Well, yes, I think so. One doesn't. Most people don't like change, and we knew him well, and he was a Durham, but he was a fairly quiet commander, I would say, and not one that was out in front or the thing. Not that I'm suggesting he should have been, but there's not one that was a very extrovert type. I mean, let us compare for the moment, say, him with, say, General Horrocks. Well, everybody knew General Horrocks, and he was a tremendous extrovert and a tremendous leader. But Brigadier Percy, he had conducted a retreat from Gazala as well as anyone could, I think. And he'd done a good job there, and I think he'd done an adequate job in the Alamein line, and indeed in the Battle of Alamein, but the corps commander decided a change was needed. So that took place.
So what happened next, Major?
Well, we then, the rest of November and then the first week of December, we started some serious training. It's always said that the best time to do training is immediately after you've been in action. And I think there's quite a bit in that. Because training before action, particularly if no one had been in action, something has got to be done in such a way, and people don't realise the reason for it. And after they've been in action, they realise unless they do that, they probably won't remain alive. So training after action is certainly valuable, and we started doing that a lot. We got quite big reinforcements. We had a reinforcement of 6 officers and 213 other ranks during this time. A and B Company were then separated again and reformed, and C Company and S Company, that support company, were made up to strength.
Where were these reinforcements coming from?
Well, from the infantry base depot, and with this second lot, most of them were Durhams, although there were other regiments as well, particularly amongst the NCOs. We had an NCOs cadre to try and some new NCOs, because after it's always the leaders that go in any battle, usually. We did section platoon training. We made a football pitch, and we had the RSM organise that, and we had some football games. And the CO organised an officer's toot. A toot is a tactical exercise without troops. And we went back to our old positions in the New Zealand. And it was very interesting because we went down into the depression in front of us, and we went into the German-Italian positions and looked back at ours, And that was really quite a fascinating day, looking at it from the enemy's point of view. Snags at this time, if you can call them that, one was the flies. Well, this bit of desert, of course, had been occupied by troops now for years, and the flies were absolutely horrendous. They were quite unbelievable. And, you know, you were brushing them off your food before you could put it in your mouth, and this sort of thing. They just covered everything. Anyway, the medical officer got some system of arsenic traps going, and this brought pretty good havoc, and I think we left the place. It's partly hygiene, really, too, and that's a matter of discipline. And I think we had a staff on clearing the place up, and I think we left it a little bit better than we'd found it. The second thing was jaundice, and jaundice became very prevalent in the 8th Army at that time. And curiously enough, it was more prevalent amongst officers and sergeants than it was amongst the other ranks. And there were all sorts of theories put out about this, and people said, "Oh, it's drinking gin and beer in messes that gives them jaundice," and all this. But I think the medical people were seriously worried about it, and we had a number of those officers. Well, then we began on the 8th of December to move up west, and the first staging area was Galal, that's between Darba and Fuka, and then we went on next to west of Matru, and we left the road then and headed across the desert in brigade group column. In other words, it wasn't only the three battalions of the brigade, but also the 74th Field Regiment, Royal Artillery, and the 505 Field Company, the sappers, and 149 Field Ambulance, and the whole lot in one brigade column. And the routine was similar, really, to the one we practiced moving from Iraq. We'd leave probably 7:30 in the morning and motor for a safe, and then the halt would be made, and off would come the brew cans, and before you knew where you were, you had a cup of tea in your hand, and you fed on a truck basis, and we had biscuits and cheese and perhaps a bit of bully and that sort of thing, and quite a good, adequate lunch, and then off we'd go again. And then we got to the staging area, marked out by the advance party, and up went the tents, and when one got practice, they went up pretty quick, and down again in the morning pretty quick. And it was really quite a good life. I say, we went across the desert then towards Bir el Talata, and that had been the army railhead for the Crusader operation in 1941. And on west from there to the frontier between Egypt and Tripoli and Tripolitania at Bir Shafirzin. And then on the 10th of December we reached the divisional assembly area, which was near Sidi Rezaig, which was again well known for the battle in the Crusader operation in 1941. And we settled in there about the 12th of December, and we were due to stay there to get ourselves as comfortable as we could. We got some new reinforcements again, including a new second in command, Major Hugh Blackton, who had been in the Transjordan Frontier Force, I think. It was the first experience in the desert. Training again, we had the 3-day divisional exercise in about the third week in December, and then we changed all that on the 20th and and started doing drill and smartening up and all this, because on the 22nd we were going to be inspected by General Horrocks, who at that time was commanding 10 Corps, and he inspected the battalion and spoke to everybody and also presented awards which had been won at Alamein. And then Christmas was on us, and the quartermaster, George Stray, and OC head quarter company, who was Captain Petro Cucino, Greek extraction, I think, and the most marvellous man who everyone called Petro. And those two together did a fantastic job in going to Dubrook and waiting in queues and getting Christmas goodies for us, and we sat down to a turkey and Christmas pudding and agreed dried greens, but they were green vegetables anyway, and served of course by the officers, as is tradition, and there was a bottle of beer a man, and free issue, and a few more to buy, so everyone had a real, in the circumstances, fantastic Christmas. And that was Christmas 42, of course. And then straight after that, we had an exercise with cooperation with tanks for the 50th RTR. And during this time, the Jake Jackson, the CO, arranged a visit for some of us. It was about a party of about 8 or 10. To go back to our old Gazala box, and this was absolutely fascinating, really, because it was the same as we'd left it, with the exception that all the food and all the water had gone, but everything else was left. For instance, the officer's mess sergeant Cutty's watch was hanging on the pole of his dugout tent, and I found a pair of boots which I'd left, and I knew exactly where they were, and there they were, and this sort of thing. And the Germans had been nowhere near. I think it was too far south anyway, and they were busy pursuing the British, and the only people who'd been there were the Bedouin, and they'd taken the water and the food. It was really an amazing experience. And then we didn't have much, we had to move on west again.